So, I don't think I need this. As the name suggests, I'm going to talk about some research threads in a film that I'm working on now called The Night Visitors that has to do with moths and being around them. I've been working on it for a long time, a couple of years, and I often ask myself, why don't I stop working on it? Why don't I finish it? Lately I've been realizing it's because I like doing it. I like working on them, and I'm afraid that when I finish it, I won't like it as much. Maybe you've had that experience as a maker or a writer, that you have some research idea, some idea, and you dig into it, and then when it's done, you're like, oh, well, now I'm not so interested. So I'm going to keep working on this for a while. So why make a film about moths? I'm interested in moths, of course, as biological organisms with really fascinating life histories and unbelievably staggering biodiversity. There are about 11,000 moth species in North America in the U.S., compared with about 725 butterfly species for you butterfly people. And of course, a kind of functional importance as indicators of climate change and habitat degradation. But my engagement with moths is not really scientific or is not primarily entomological. Rather, I'm drawn to them, to moths, as aesthetic beings and as carriers of meaning. And I use the term carriers of meaning to denote not only the meaning that moths or really any other animal have for us, not really just meaning, but meanings that animals might have for us, but also the meaning that the world carries for the moth. And the phrase carriers of meaning and the provocative, even outlandish idea that the world holds meaning for a moth is derived from Jacob van Uexkool, mid-20th century Estonian-German biologist, best known for the concept of the Umwelt, which literally means surrounding world, but can be thought of as an organism's relationship to the world through its sensoria. For van Uexkool, an organism's relationship to the world is a sign relationship, and that doesn't matter if it's a moth or a deer or a human. It's a kind of relationship, a semiotic relationship, a relationship of meaning. So a mite, a moth, a mouse, a cat, a bat, and a human are in a room. So it sounds like the setup to a joke. They're all in the same room, but the carriers of meaning in that room are different for each organism. And that's really what van Uexkool's Umwelt is about, in a way, these different carriers of meaning based on shape, on the organism's shape and scale and locomotion and food source and desire and sensory capability, and in the case of human and some other organisms, culture. The first principle of Umwelt theory is that every organism is fitted into its own world with equal completeness. The idea of the Umwelt gives us a tool, I think, or I hope, a tool to think about the interiority of each organism on its own terms, not just to think of them as reduced humans or flawed humans or humans that aren't quite human. So what does it mean to think about the interiority of a moth? And what does it mean to do so through a camera? And in particular, what is the role of the close-up in this sense of interiority? And Laska and Jason kind of addressed this a little bit, or quite a bit, in fact. There are, of course, a lot of jobs that we ask a close-up to do. But as Laska and Jason said, whether in fiction or nonfiction, one of the central tasks of a close-up is to give us a sense, however incomplete that sense may be, of the inner life of the person about whom we're making the close-up. The same can be said, of course, of images of animals in film, or at least the way images of animals in films are used in conventional nature documentaries. So we see a close-up of a lion or a penguin or an owl or a whatever that mammal was. I'm not sure what that mammal was. And we are given to think that we understand something about the lion or penguin's inner life. But what does it mean to make a close-up of a creature whose inner life is so different from our own that it's impossible to describe in a way? It may not even really have an inner life in a way that we would understand. It doesn't have an inner life in a way that we would understand, probably. I look at this face in detail and search those eyes for something, but that something remains hidden. That face is unreadable. So what other frame might we use to approach that blank space? One approach might be made through science fiction, which gives us a way to express the incommensurable otherness of animals in general and insects in particular. And of course, there's a long history in cinema of using insects to provoke both wonder and revulsion. This is a GIF I made from a film that I found in the Library of Congress, made in 1915 by Thomas Edison Company. It is one of the earliest, if not the earliest, film image of a moth. As a side note, it strikes me as a kind of ironic thread to be pulled, that this film of a moth has Thomas Edison's name on it, and so does the electric light bulb, at least in popular histories, the electric light bulb that would be for moths an irresistible apocalypse. This image from a few years later, the late 20s or early 30s, isn't an insect, of course, it's a crab claw, shot by French filmmaker Jean Painlevé, whose science films of seahorses and octopi, among many other creatures, imbue the world with a surrealist sense of the uncanny. From roughly the same period, you'll recognize this image, of course, or these two images, from roughly the same period in the same place as Painlevé, and perhaps with mutual influence flowing back and forth, here are two images from Dalí and Buñuel's Un Chien Andalou. The image on the right of the death's head moth will, of course, remind a contemporary audience of promotional material for Silence of the Lambs. But the image on the left of ants crawling out of a hand was also used in promotional material for a later film, which I've never seen. Has anybody seen this film? Phase Four, the only film apparently directed by Saul Bass, who's better known as the title director for many Hitchcock films. Of course, moths have also appeared in science fiction films, not just other insects. From the 1964 version of Mothra versus Godzilla, though actually I think Godzilla got top billing. Which, after a little detour, brings us back to my images, which I think of that as a kind of science fiction image. A couple more threads I want to weave in before looking at a bit of the film. With moths, I learned a new way of looking at the world in a way. When I started looking at moths, I started looking at these things in my backyard that I didn't know existed. Most of the images that we're looking at were filmed 30 feet from my house. I had no idea that this rich ecosystem existed. And as with any body of knowledge, knowing a name is a key that opens a lock. The history of binomial genus species scientific naming, with its roots in the Enlightenment project of knowing the world and its corollary in the colonialist project of controlling the world, is too big of an aside to go into here, though it's a troubled thread that I want the film to tease out a bit. But what I did want to briefly touch on here is the pleasure and poetry of moth common names in English. So I've got this little list here, and we won't really look at them for very long. Going to go on. Another set of threads that the film follows are some of the ways that the built environment impacts and continues to impact these beings that I'm interested in this film, and all beings. In an age that we've come to call, of course, the Anthropocene, though I sort of prefer the evolutionary biologist E.O. Wilson's term, the Eremocene, the age of loneliness. Because it, I think, gets something a bit more of a sense of the impact on the rest of the world, not just on us. So these are some clips that some newspaper clippings that I found from I think it's called the Times Machine. The New York Times has this really great resource where all of their early newspapers are available. And in 1909, there was a plague of moths, as they described it, another shower of white moths. They swooped down on the city again by the million and pestered humanity, so, which kind of brings us back to the science fiction. This is a little bit later. This is the moth, I think, that they're talking about, called the snow white tiger moth. This is a little bit later. Fluttering army of moth invades the city. Mysterious swarms beset autoists and shops. Restaurants are forced to close. So in a way, I think this gives a sense of the sheer density, the biodensity that used to exist and no longer does, in a way. Sure, I can take a picture of this moth in my backyard, and there are some of them, but there are no longer millions of them to descend on a city. To attempt to move toward the interiority of other animals, particularly insects, is to approach a kind of epistemological abyss. In Thomas Nagel's foundational 1974 essay, What Is It Like to Be a Bat?, he argues that this epistemological or philosophical abyss should be regarded as a challenge to, quote, devise an objective phenomenology not dependent on empathy or imagination, end quote. In contrast, I think I would argue that chasm, the chasm presented by animal interiority, really can't be crossed except by empathetic imagination. So with that, I want to show you a bit of the film.
So I trap moths, and I do that using what are called bucket traps. The basic setup of a bucket trap is that there is a light at the top, and the light sits above a funnel. The funnel sits in the mouth of a bucket, so that when the moth comes to the light, it is going to fall down into the funnel, which has slick sides, and it slides down into the bucket. The next morning, I go early in the morning and pick up the traps. I take the killing agent out of the bucket traps at that time and put it back into sealed containers. Then I bring the bucket traps to the lab on campus, typically where I know that I'm going to be processing them. I will empty the contents of the trap onto a white surface, And then I sort out the moths and I group them by family first off. Then I go back and I will go through each family and do the species identification. As I'm going through and doing the identification, I will choose which individuals that I'm going to keep and pin. And while I'm doing that, I'm of course making a list of each species name and how many individuals that I had of that species. Then all of that data will get entered into my database to establish flight times and look at changes in the numbers of individuals of a particular species that I might have gotten at different times. The dates that I am getting now could be referred to in the future to see if there's been a shift in the flight dates that I encountered versus someone in the future. And potentially species that are moving northward that I didn't have any records for that might then show up in the future because they've been able to move farther northward with climate change. Someone can spend hours on something that someone else would look at and say, wow, that's just tedious. You're doing the same thing over and over. I don't look at it that way. There's just so much more to it for me than just sorting and quickly writing down names. There's a quiet reverence about going through it. I don't want to rush. I don't need to rush it. I want to enjoy looking at these individual organisms as I go through this process of sorting the trap contents.